The History of Stonehenge, Part 2, The Construction of Stonehenge. Now, the first Stonehenge comprised the bank and the ditch enclosing what are known as the Aubrey Stones. And there was probably a ceremonial gateway on roughly the present alignment. There may have been a timbered building in the center, but there's no evidence of it surviving. The site was built around 3100 BC, but was only used for about 500 years, after which it reverted to scrub. Now, the earlier structures, like I said, were the bank, the ditch, and the Aubrey holes, named after the gentleman who explored them. There is probably some kind of gateway or ceremonial arch of timber a little to the west of the present heel stones on the axis of the circular earthworks, and a pair of small stones standing in the middle of the entrance, forming a doorway without a lintel. Perhaps, too, there were some small buildings of timber or setting stones at the center in an area long since destroyed by treasure hunters. The Aubrey holes are round pits in the chalk about 1 meter wide and deep, with steep sides and flat bottoms, or forming a circle of 284 feet in diameter. They seem to have been filled up very soon after they were dug. Later cremated human bones were buried in the smaller holes in the chalk filling, but there is no reason to suppose they were made as graves in the first place, although that's not impossible, and they certainly did not hold uprights of wood or stone. It is possible that the four station stones belong to this period also, but again, the evidence is uncertain. There are few similar open-air temples of much smaller size, containing rings of pits with ceremonial burials that have been found elsewhere in Britain. But like Stonehenge, they all probably belong to the late Neolithic period. And of course, after about 500 years, this whole site reverted back to scrub. So then we get to the arrival of the blue stones. Now, the second development stage occurred around 2100 BC when Stonehenge was radically remodeled. Some 40 blue stones from the Preseli Mountains in the southwest part of Wales were set up in the center, forming an incomplete double circle. The entrance was widened and a pair of heel stones erected. The nearer part of the avenue was built and then aligned with the midsummer sunrise. Now, these 80 blue stones weigh up to 4 tons each, and they were set up to form two circles, one inside the other, round the center of the site. There was an entrance pointing towards the rising sun in midsummer, marked externally by a pair of heel stones and by an extra set of stones on the inside. And on the opposite side, a large pit may have held a blue stone of larger size, or perhaps the present altar stone, which is not an altar. There was also some kind of interior setting, possibly a horseshoe, of which only a few holes are actually known. The blue stones may have been brought to Stonehenge from some undiscovered site in Wiltshire, to which they had been transported century before for another purpose. The excavation have shown, however, that this double circle was never finished, and that for the last quarter of its circumference to the west side, the stones were not set up. At the same time, the original entrance, the circle earthwork, was widened by throwing about 25 feet of the bank back into the ditch on the east side, and from here, the nearer part of the avenue was built on the same sunrise alignment, and the pair of heel stones was enclosed in a narrow ditch, almost at once filled up again. The avenue provided the approach to Stonehenge, and it's marked on the ground by two parallel ditches with banks on the inside. From the entrance of Stonehenge, it passes the surviving heel stone and runs downhill about 1,740 feet to the dry valley called Stonehenge Bottom. The remodeling of Stonehenge was probably the work of local people. It looks as if the building of the double bluestone circle was still in progress when the decision was made, for reasons we shall never know, to abandon it and replace it with something much larger. And that much larger part is the arrival of the Sarsen stones. Now, this new structure probably started about 2000 BC. It was a lintelled circle and horseshoe of large Sarsen stones whose remains can be seen today. Its axis, like that of the unfinished double circle, which it replaced, pointed to the midsummer sunrise and was marked externally by a single heel stone inside a small circular ditch, and internally by a pair of large stones set close together at the entrance of the earthworks, only one of which, the fallen slaughter stone, now survives. And again, nobody was using it as a sacrifice. This extraordinary building exhibits a number of refinements that cannot be found anywhere else amongst the prehistoric stone monuments of Europe outside the Mediterranean area. First, all the stones have been squared and dressed to shape by pounding their surfaces with heavy stone hammers before they were erected. Second, the lintels are held in place on their uprights by mortise and tenon joints worked into the solid stone, and the lintels of the outer circle are locked end to end by vertical tongue and groove joints as well. Thirdly, the lintels themselves are not straight-sided blocks, but they have their sides shaped to the curves on which they lie. Furthermore, the sides of the trilithon lintels are not vertical, but are inclined towards the ground. These are all refinements of a design which are peculiar to Stonehenge alone. The joining of the stones is probably imitation of woodworking methods, and we've known that at much the same time, huge timber structures were being erected nearby in Woodhenge, as well as at Durrington Wells. The upward taper of the Sarsen pillars may likewise imitate the natural tapering form of tree trunks, but it could possibly represent a deliberate, though crude, attempt to increase the apparent height of the stones by an optical illusion. Similarly, the tilting sides of the trilithon lintels does have the effect, and perhaps intentionally, of making them look as if they are vertical to an observer inside the horseshoe. Given the size and weight of the stones, and the primitive means available for moving, shaping, and erecting them, this Sarsen building of the early Bronze Age represents one of the most remarkable and astonishing of all the achievements of prehistoric man in Europe. Now, I would point out that the tallest Sarsen, which is one of the main upright in the central trilithon, weighs over 45 tons and is 22 feet high. And its lintel has fallen and lies in front of it, so you can easily see where they carved that out. And you can also see the mortise and tenon joints when you get close-up position. Now, the next stage of Stonehenge involved a selection of about 20 bluestones, which were shaped and erected in an oval setting inside the Sarsen horseshoe. At least two miniature copies in bluestones were made of the great Sarsen trilithons. Their separated components still survive. Sometime around 1550 BC, two rings of holes were dug to form, again, a double circle of bluestones, but this project was ultimately abandoned. Now, we do not know the date of this oval setting of the dressed bluestones. It could have been part of the same design as the Sarsen stones and completed as soon as they had been set up. Equally, it could have been a fresh addition at a later date. In either case, however, it seems to have been the intention of the builders to make use in the end of the remaining 60 bluestones left over from period 2, which had not so far been dressed to shape. It is almost certainly two rings of holes were dug around 1500 BCE to form once again a double circle. For some unknown reason, however, this project also was abandoned, unfinished. The last few holes to be dug on the east side were irregular and incomplete, and no stones were ever set in any of them. The design was abandoned, and the oval setting of the bluestones in the center was actually demolished. The final reconstruction of Stonehenge probably followed almost at once. The uprights of the former oval structure were reset in the horseshoe of bluestones that we can see the remains of today, and probably reshaped to their present alternating forms of pillar and obelisk. The remaining unshaped bluestones were erected in the present bluestone circle, together with the two bluestone lintels, reused as pillars with the mortise holes facing outward so that they could not be seen from the inside. Both have since fallen over in different directions so that the mortises on one of them now lies underground. The original number of stones in the bluestone circle was probably about 60, set quite close together, but most of them have since been broken up or removed, or survive only as battered stumps below ground level. The largest bluestone of all, the altar stone, probably stood as a tall pillar on the axial line inside the central area and the highest Sarsen trilithon, and it has since fallen, and there is no reason to suppose that its present position or its name is more than accidental. At about 1100 BC, the avenue was extended from Stonehenge Bottom to pass over the hill to the east, and from there southeast to the River Avon. This must mean that Stonehenge was still in use at the date and presumably for some time afterwards. We just don't know how long. But ultimately, the whole area is plowed over and becomes farmland with the stones still standing in position. What we see today is the last segment of construction. And of course, one of the things that we'll get to later on is a lot of those stones had fallen. They were reset and put into place in modern times after significant archaeological discussion and surveys. It's really easy to go completely nuts here on all of the different variations. I mean, some people go, well, look, when was that built? But then you go, well, look, have it here, you have it here, you have it here, and then it's abandoned. So one of those great archaeological puzzles. Sherry and I have done a video podcast on YouTube on our external tour around Stonehenge. We're talking about the history and everything else. And it will be followed by a second one, which will be the internal picture that we took when we were inside of Stonehenge on our tour. So stop by the Bob Packett channel on YouTube if you'd like to get a look at those. Now, as far as the sources for this, Stonehenge by Bishop, Stonehenge and Neighboring Monuments by J.C. Atkinson, Stonehenge of Kings by Crampton, Stonehenge Decoded by Hawkins, and Beyond Stonehenge also by Hawkins. Thank you very much.